Daniel, it's great to have you on this morning. Thank you for this. Let's start with the Masai Ujiri lawsuit update. This is the situation out in the Bay Area where this police officer alleges that he was assaulted by Masai as Masai tried to make his way onto the court to join the Raptors in celebration after the Game 6 victory that closed down Oracle Arena. Masai has now countered, saying that he was acting in self-defense when he shoved this security officer. Where is this headed? Is this security officer actually going to get something out of this, like some kind of settlement, even if small, out of court?
Yeah, I would think that given the security guard's very interesting background, and I'll get into that in a second, a case like this is highly unlikely to ever actually go to trial because of the amount of the amount of money involved. This is simply the type of litigation that parties, at least in federal court, I've litigated so many cases and very few of them ever make it to trial. I think this is the type of case where the NBA, the Raptors, the organization, the building, they will find a nuisance value to get rid of it. Because from this plaintiff's perspective, he has a lot of baggage in his background. He was convicted of insurance fraud a little bit over a decade ago. He filed a workers' compensation claim. And he hasn't been working for the Alameda County Sheriff's Office ever since the incident. Now, if we go back and review the videotape, it seemed like he was a pretty robust, a healthy person. How do you go from that situation to now claiming, your psychological, physical damage, serious long-term injury, when all that transpired here were two men shoving each other during a very brief period of time? So ultimately, this case should be settled. He's not going to get $1 million, but he'll probably get something because the NBA and the Raptors will probably want to put this to bed and not, shine a spotlight on this incident by having depositions and a jury trial. It's worth it for the league and for the team to eventually pay him off at some point, because they're not going to get rid of him by filing motions to dismiss or all these pretrial motions. This is a classic case with competing stories. I guess it's referred to as he said, she said. It's not the type of storyline that can be resolved on the pleadings. It will take some discovery, some depositions, and potentially it would probably have to go to trial to factually determine what happened here.
And I'm biased given this security officer's background, of which I was aware before you pointed it out, Daniel. I mean, this just seems extremely litigious to me. And it occurs to me that this probably isn't this security officer's first rodeo going down this path, and that this is the way a guy like this chooses to live his life. If there is an opportunity to extract money out of a figure, it's clear to me. What's clear to me about this, the facts as I understand them, is he had no idea who Masai Ujiri was, which is why he tried to prevent Masai Ujiri from getting onto the court. And then the moment he finds out it's the president of basketball operations for the Toronto Raptors, it says, oh my goodness, this is a man with money. And then he goes after him. I mean, that's the way that I draw this up in my mind. It's insanity.
Security guards have been in shoving incidents with fans at public venues for time immemorial, and they don't end up in litigation. I mean, there was a recent incident in Madison Square Garden involving Charles Oakley, former member of the Toronto Raptors, for a brief period of time, where he got into a fight with a group of securities officers, and Oakley sued the Garden and the owner of the team for assault. But I would point out that the physicality in that incident was much more demonstrative than what appeared to take place in the Ujiri case. Yet the officers in the Madison Square Garden incident naturally didn't bring suit. So I'm not going to cast aspersions on his motivations, but certainly he has a very questionable and potentially troubling background as to how he has, I wouldn't say how he has lived his life, but how he has filed insurance claims, fraudulent, convicted of insurance fraud. And now, more recently, he's filed a workers' compensation claim. And Alameda County tried to take his testimony on the issue of the incident with the jury, which gave rise to his workers' comp claim. And he's refused to answer any questions. So there's a lot to unpack here. And I think the NBA and the Raptors and New Jersey, when they have an opportunity, are anxious to take his deposition and expose and draw out facts that can undermine the credibility of the witness and undermine the, you know, the credibility of his claim. And that will happen in due course. But now that we're in a pause with the coronavirus emergency conditions, not only are sports slow down, but the court system has also grinded to a halt. There are no jury trials. There are unlikely to be any depositions except conducted telephonically. And this is the kind of deposition of a witness that you'd want to have in person. So I would imagine that this case is going to take a little bit longer to play out, given the current public health crisis in which we're operating.
What would you advise Masai to do in a situation like this? Would you countersue to maybe make the whole thing kind of go away and put a little bit of pressure on the security guard?
I mean, I'm not sure that could pose too much of a threat to the security officer, who may not have that much money to begin with. I mean, you could file all the claims in the world you want, but if you can't collect, it's really not of any great value. I think the best thing he could do is put on a strong defense and try to gather the type of evidence, take witness testimony, get a copy. He probably he could probably get access to the videotape evidence from the Oracle Arena that might actually, tell the true story. There are other witnesses who were present that night who testified that the officer initiated the incident and was the first person who shoved anybody. And Ujiri's answer, and he filed an answer about 2 weeks ago, his answer claims that the officer was the aggressor and shoved him three times before Ujiri pushed him back. So ultimately, what Ujiri and the Raptors organization can do here is locate and identify witnesses who may be able to provide more clarity as to the incident. But ultimately, the videotape that the arena undoubtedly or claims to possess, which hasn't been revealed publicly yet, might be able to shed more light on this story. And if the video shows that the officer pushed him first, I think it will undermine the officer's assault and battery claim. And this case could eventually settle. I don't think it's going to take that much money. This is not a $1 million case. There are no long-lasting, at least visible injuries. The officer, if you look at some of the videotapes that emerged in the aftermath of the incident, he didn't look too worse for wear. If you review the videotape, so I think that this case will probably be settled in the 5 to 6 figure range. This is definitely not the type of 7-figure settlement where someone has suffered lasting, visible, obvious injuries.
Daniel Wallach is our guest, Sportsnet legal analyst. You're listening to Leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Daniel, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but there is a clause, and this was reported by a man by the name of Justin Dunk, a CFL reporter on the Three Down Nation website. There's a clause in the CFL's collective bargaining agreement. Still some clarification to go on this, but there is a clause which states that if any CFL season is suspended, all player contracts are voided. Now, the CFL has, to varying degrees, had financial difficulty over the last 2.5-3 decades, and so that clause, we presume, has been put in to protect the league. But here we are in the COVID-19 pandemic. And if the 2020 season is suspended as a result of coronavirus, there is a possibility that each and every player in the Canadian Football League becomes a free agent. It would just be complete league-wide chaos, and I suppose it would drum up interest because each team would be able to start from scratch and build their teams up as they see fit, target the players that they like best. You've done some deep dives into some of the other collective bargaining agreements. Are there any nuggets that you've come away with that could somehow, some way, be tied to COVID-19 or something like COVID-19?
Sure, sure. A classic example of this is the National Basketball Association's collective bargaining agreement with the players that actually has a force majeure clause that specifies epidemics and the types of, public health crisis that the COVID-19, most certainly is. So the NBA had the foresight back in 2011 during the prior CBA to insert that type of provision to protect the league and to protect the teams in the event of something like a pandemic or an epidemic. And in that instance, because the language is very specific, the NBA has the leverage have the player guarantees for at least the rest of the season voided once and assuming that the NBA cancels the season. Right now, the NBA is only suspended the season, and they have not activated the force majeure clause. What I can take away from that, and based upon my own understanding and analysis of state law, at least in New York, where the NBA is headquartered, you need to be very specific in drafting these force majeure clauses. The CFL is not going to just be able to willy-nilly cancel the season. The cancellation, they could cancel the season, but that force majeure clause has to be very specific as to the kinds of causes and the kinds of, irresistible and unavoidable events that are beyond the control of the league. It can't just provide general language that gives the league the right to cancel contracts. These clauses have to specify the specific event. It doesn't have to say coronavirus or epidemic, but it has to come pretty close to that. So I think the devil will be in the details, and depending upon how specific the force majeure clause is, that will correspond to a greater leverage on the league's part to be able to void guarantees and cancel contracts. And in the NBA's case, there may even be a right to void the collective bargaining agreement altogether and start over. The current CBA ends in 2025, but based upon a cancellation of the season for any of the conditions that are specified in the NBA's force majeure clause, they can void the whole deal. And depending on how severe financially this thing is, it could give the league an opportunity to grab a greater revenue share or to alter the terms of employment in a way that is, deleterious to the player's position. So it really does depend on what the CFL language actually states.
On your Twitter, you said that New Hampshire is being considered as a potential site for NHL games, and if it resumes, and that, they could host maybe in Manchester, New Hampshire. Is this, what can you tell us about that with betting that's legalized in the state and how that would impact the league?
Well, I think we all were excited. At least I was excited because I teach at University of New Hampshire School of Law among my other responsibilities. So when I read that the league was purportedly considering Manchester, New Hampshire, I was excited by that. But in reality, I think it's impractical because there's only one hockey arena. And for that one hockey arena to be able to service 30 NHL teams in a compressed schedule seems like a bit of a reach for me. That if the NHL was going to conduct games in a single state, which is, I think, what some of the leagues are looking at, Major League Baseball is purportedly considering Arizona, which has multiple playing fields and stadiums. I think to realistically host an entire sports federation within one state, you'll need multiple venues. And to my knowledge, New Hampshire doesn't possess multiple venues, just have that one 9,000-seat arena in Manchester, New Hampshire. But as far as the betting is concerned, this would raise an interesting optic because New Hampshire is one of the few states that have legalized, I wouldn't say few, but one of about 15 states that have actually launched sports betting operations in the United States. And Manchester will be the site of retail, brick and mortar sports book operations that will be run by DraftKings. So if the NHL plays in Manchester, New Hampshire, this will be like a miniature Las Vegas with sports books throughout the city of New Hampshire, Manchester, New Hampshire, while the league is playing games. But given the scale of the National Hockey League and the sheer number of teams, potentially playing in only one small rink in New Hampshire, I don't think this day will ever come. I think the league, if the league is seriously considering playing in a single location, it will probably choose a state that has more facilities and more suitable venues to be able to accommodate as many as 30-some-odd NHL teams.
Well, that would be exciting. I lived in Nashua, New Hampshire for a year, not too far south of you, so that would be quite interesting.
Especially for the Bruins. Can you imagine if the games were played in Manchester? That would provide a built-in home ice advantage for the Boston Bruins for the entirety of the playoffs. I mean, I don't think they would be playing in front of fans, but imagine if they were. That would just be, it would really create an unlevel playing field by giving the Bruins basically a crowd that favors their team game in and game out. But there will not be any fans when there is a resumption of the games. If it's May, if it's June, July, August, I think that's going to be too soon and too risky from a public health perspective to house thousands of fans in a single building. They will be playing and skating before empty seats if and when the season resumes.
Well, Daniel, you can appreciate that those of us here in Toronto aren't particularly interested in any idea that gives the Boston Bruins another advantage. We've had enough trouble with the Bruins up here as it is.
And I still remember those 2013 playoffs where the Maple Leafs had the Bruins on the verge of extinction, and the Bruins scored 3 goals in the last 8 minutes.
Yeah,
and I know this firsthand because I was rooting for Toronto and against Boston because the Rangers, who are my favorite team, had to play Boston in the next round. So.
Right.
You know what happened next. The Bruins win the series, and then they smoke the Rangers in the quarterfinals. So I know firsthand the pain that Toronto feels over their past rivalries with the Bruins. But like all things, the pendulum will swing in the other direction as the Bruins get older, which they are, and the Maple Leafs are a team on the rise.
Great insight as always, Daniel. Thank you so much, and we'll call on you again very soon.